I would like to welcome you to tonight's program, Same Dynamics, New Directions, Centering Race, Class, and Gender in Transformative Education. Critical race theory, in a very general sense, looks at how the concept of race affects relations among individuals. This theory began within the legal field during the mid-70s. It was then, and still is, applied in different contexts when cases of institutionalized oppression of racial minorities are litigated in courts. Since then, it has spread to many other disciplines. In the social sciences, for instance, critical race theory has been used to analyze and work against racism. In education, it has enabled teachers and professors to understand the dynamics of race and racism, not only inside the classroom, but also in the local communities. Having a better understanding of race and its role in our society is the first step towards a more equitable environment. Critical race theory also allows educators to rethink their practice and challenge themselves in order to help students question and contest controlling cultural assumptions and beliefs. Through this approach, teachers are able to encourage students to become aware of who they are in the world and the work it will take to change it. David Stovall received his PhD from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in 2001. He's an associate professor of Educational Policy Studies and African American Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His research primarily focuses on four areas: critical race theory, concepts of social justice in education, the relationship between housing and education, and the relationship between schools and community stakeholders. Professor Stovall has spent the last 3 years working with community organizations and schools to develop curriculum that addresses issues of social justice. He's also a member of the Greater London Little Village School of Social Justice High School Design Team and is involved with youth-centered community organizations in Chicago, New York, and the Bay Area. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, since this program is being taped and some of our audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking a question during the question and answer session at the end of this program. We will hold a continue the conversation session on this program tomorrow at 12:30 p.m. in Holland Union Building Side Room 206. Professor Stovall will be joining the group, and all are welcome. Please bring your own lunch. Desserts will be provided. Now, please join me welcoming Professor David Stovall.
Thanks so much. Everybody, can everybody hear me all right? Yeah, I'm usually not worried about my teacher voice, but I know since they got the tape, they got the tape moving, I'm always concerned on whether or not I get caught by the camera or what have you, because sometimes I've tried to do it with myself in my classrooms and use a lavalier mic, and when I'm taping, sometimes I'll tape my class and then I'll play it back and it'll be totally silent. So hopefully that's not the case. But again, I would just like to thank personally all the folks at the Clark Forum, especially Jolie Rankin, for getting everything together. We've been actually putting this together since June, July, to actually get this together. And I also should probably give a shout out to the folks on YouTube, because I guess that was one of the ways that people actually saw me talk and actually get into the business of talking about schools, race, racism, the same dynamics and new directions. Now, again, I'm not in many ways typical in my presentation style, and so if a curse word comes, just roll with the punches, because it's coming. And I just want to be honest with that. And it's a way for me to just keep myself honest around what it is that I'm talking about, because I try to be very intentional about what I'm talking about. Sometimes to a fault, and sometimes it gets you in trouble. But I am clear about what it is that I'm trying to do, and I struggle with it daily. And I just want to make sure that I am reflective of those struggles in my conversation with us tonight. So I probably won't talk longer, because I think most of our most of the dialogue and interaction will probably come better when folks start to have questions. But one of the things that I want to do, and I want to give a shout out to the folks whose class I talked in today, the Ed Foundations over in one of the halls. I messed up with the names. I see some familiar faces, but one love to y'all for coming out to the spot. Being here in Dickinson has been interesting. You know, that coming here, you know, I'm from Chicago, born and raised in Chicago, and then you fly in and you fly in right over Three Mile Island, right? So it's just kind of like, ooh, all right. And I remember having to do a current event report on Three Mile Island when I was in like fourth grade. So I've been telling everybody this for the last couple of days. And then actually understanding Carlisle for the Carlisle School for Native American Children. And understanding that history and the complexities in that history, and being in a place like Carlisle that has such a deep history that's ingrained in a conversation about race. Now, I'm going to make a couple of arguments, but first I want to break down some of the rhetoric that we hear now in teaching. A lot of times in teaching, you hear folks talk about social justice. You hear folks talk about transformative pedagogy. And for me, I'm always asking this question, what does that mean? Because we exist in this rhetoric and we were always talking about something, but are we really prepared to engage it? Because for me, I'm a talker, right? But I'm really not impressed by rhetoric. I'm more impressed by what people are actually doing based on what they know. So when we're talking about transformative teaching, what I'm talking about is this notion of understanding the plight of yourself and your students, and the conscious decisions that you make in changing those realities, including your own. And again, these are not popular decisions. And I don't want to come here and martyr myself about, you know, everybody comes and is woe is me. But really to make these important decisions, because I'm going to make another argument. We do not have a comprehensive discussion around race, class, gender, sexuality, or ability in the United States. We don't. And I think we need to start there. And when we start there, we can begin to have much more difficult conversations, because now we exist in rhetoric. And let's use an example of how this rhetoric exists. November 5th. If Barack Obama wins November 5th, then it becomes all black folks, shut up. You got one in the White House. That's a problem. Because Barack Obama's success, although individual and great, does not solve the racial problem in the United States. We haven't had that discussion since 1548, right? Not 1619, because remember, the Spaniards was in a little part called Florida. We never want to talk about that, right? But since 1548, we have not had this conversation. And when we do have this conversation, we want to make everybody safe and comfortable. And to me, that's a cop-out, because conversations around race are not safe nor comfortable. And again, these conversations are imbued in class, in gender, in sexuality. And again, I don't want to be dismissive of any of them. And I'm arguing that you especially cannot be dismissive of them if you're working with young folks every day. And one of the things, in addition to being a college professor, I teach high school social studies every morning, first period, right? With seniors, right? So when they come, you know, I'm like, hey, y'all, it's 8 o'clock. Everybody's just 8 o'clock. Let's get to the business of understanding that's 8 o'clock. We can get down, right? They all look like, you know, because they come in, and, you know, from whatever was happening the night before, you know, folks is fading and people walking in, and then they said might say something crazy, right? Because it's 8 o'clock in the morning and we're all dead, right? So let's work with that. But again, I understand me being there is for a particular reason. One, to test out my own theories. And then two, not to lie to them. Because in teaching, we can get into the business of lying to our students. And lying under the auspices of a state standard. Right? You know, I talked about earlier today, you know, how we're even taught Columbus. But let's get deeper. Let's get how we taught about Thomas Jefferson. Let's get how particular stories of folks are omitted. Let's get this whole understanding around movements, because, you know, even how we understand civil rights, black power, Chicano power, indigenous rights, gay rights, women's rights, becomes anesthetized because we have this short frame of time to communicate all these particular issues. And the current history curriculum in most high schools across the country is Revolutionary War, Civil War, maybe War 1812, World War I, World War II, Vietnam, that we really won? No. Then maybe a little bit of Iraq conflict, maybe. And then you might have a picture of the towers going down. Close the book. Thanks so much. Right? And I agree with Lowen, who wrote a book called Lies My Teacher Told Me, that history is even taught in a particular way to bore the shit out of you. It's taught that way. It is purposely designed that way. Now, we understand this to be true. Knowing what we know, what do we do? And here comes the test of critical race theory. Remember, critical race theory comes about actually by a group of legal scholars. So folks like Derrick Bell, Kimberly Crenshaw, Patricia Williams. And they come out by saying they actually are responding to a legal theory called critical legal studies. And critical legal studies says that the law is a class-based system. So the more money you have, the greater the propensity that you'll get off in the case, which have we seen in many cases. And now with the current economic crisis, we'll see a lot of folks who will be persecuted but not convicted. And that's coming down the hatch. But the critical race theory scholar said, no, it's just not, the legal system is just not classed. It is also raced. And how do we understand it as raced? So Derrick Bell writes a book called Race, Racism, and American Law in 1973. It comes out with four different areas: housing, education, employment, and then criminal justice. And it looks at the greater propensity of African Americans, Latinos, certain groups of Asian Americans actually being racialized in the legal system. A very determining around who and what will be considered white and what will be considered other. Now, I don't want to put white and other as these binaries. What I do want folks to understand, and this is critical in any discussion of race, racism, / white supremacy. I am not talking about people going in folks' lawns, burning crosses. I am not talking about people yelling at the McCain rally, kill the nigga. What I am talking about is a set of understandings and agreements that are known, but are very rarely discussed, that are situated in racialized understandings. What do I mean by that? The standard has often been not even white rule folks, but white middle class folks from suburbs as the standard. And everything else has been compared against that standard. And not to discount the struggles that white folks in the suburbs may have, but to understand that we have a system that is predicated on these standards. A classic example that folks often use in Chicago and other places, other urban areas, the conviction around powder cocaine is anywhere from probation to 3 years. The conviction around rock cocaine, as we call crack, is anywhere from 3 years to 15. Anywhere from possession from intent to distribute to felony possession to felony possession. So this whole notion around who's caught with crack and who's caught with powder. And then to even complicate matters, who's caught with meth and who's caught with crack. And the sentences, the varying in the sentences. When we look at schools, it becomes important to understand a couple of things, especially in urban areas. There's one group of folks who are viewed to be deserving of this particular school. There are other groups that are understood to be marginalized, invaluable, and most importantly, and I'll make this argument, disposable. And I say that clearly, and I say that intentionally. Now, knowing what we know, what do we do? Now, let's get into this notion of transformative education. being intentional about what young folks face and then actually posing a counter to what these young folks will face and actually being clear about education over school. I talked about this earlier today in a foundations class, this notion around school. Shut up, sit down, open your book, turn to page 19, shut up again. This notion around education, saying as a teacher that you might not know something and being willing to actually take your students' understandings as truth and doing your own homework around those understandings. Now, that is something very different than what we're taught currently in colleges of education. You know, you get the whole thing. Classroom sequence, scope and sequence, classroom management, maybe a little content. And it kind of reverberates. I mean, in my own college of education, we do this thing. But again, knowing what we know and knowing that most of this stuff is being taught to young folks is taught to numb them. How do we pose something different? Now, let's turn back to critical race theory. Now, critical race theory, again, comes from the legal field. In 1995, two folks, Gloria Ladson Billings and a guy named Bill Tate, write a piece in Teachers College Record called Towards a Critical Race Theory of Education. So they take the legal, part, and then they shift it and say, okay, we understand this in the legal field, but how does this work in schools, which we also know are racialized? And also classed, and also have all these divisions around particular isms and functions. But now, knowing what we know, how do we look at critical race theory? Critical race theory in education operates on five basic tenets. And these tenets are crucial in understanding, I would argue, in understanding schools. The first notion, racism is endemic. When I say endemic, that means it is here. It is part of the fabric of the United States. All we have to do is look at the Constitution and the three-fifths rule. I know what the three-fifths rule is. Africans were viewed as what? Three-fifths of a human being for the state of South Carolina, because there were many free Africans who owned land. So you had to actually create a provision to make sure that those Africans could not participate in the political process. Period. Declare them three-fifths. So this whole notion around who's accepted, who's rejected. I would encourage everybody to check out a book by Ian F. Haney Lopez called White by Law. Because remember, there's certain groups of folks who become part of this particular group. So we get the WASP from a different set of understandings. So remember, Irish folk were not members of this group. And it's important to understand that. In fact, Irish folk, in many cases, were pitted against Africans because they were in the same plot as indentured servants. But when we make particular rulings, again, a ruling comes up, a decision is made about who is representative of the whole and who will be put in the situation of the other. So again, this notion of race and racism, and again, we don't have a conversation about it. To talk about it is taboo. We're playing the what card? The race card. Oh my God, how do you call us racist? It's important to understand race as not racism, white supremacy, as not individual acts of bigotry. It is important to understand white supremacy as a system that advantages certain groups over others. So we're not talking about, again, cross burning, people yelling out. We are talking about how people participate in a system that has deemed one group valuable and others disposable. Clearly. So again, that conversation, so we don't have to get into this whole post around me calling the whole city of Carlisle racist and all this other joint. That, you know, when I was staying at the Harford House, they burned a cross in the lawn. No. The understanding is there is a system, and a system will be played in and enacted when deemed necessary. And this is what makes it more dangerous. Because again, we have these things that are understood but never discussed. Second piece in education, the centrality of narrative. So this whole notion that our stories are important and valuable, not necessarily to the factual record, but actually in acting and trusting our students, I'm bringing it back to the classroom, trusting our students as valuable. And this gets us away from traditional schooling and into education, because we forget the root word of education, which is educe. And educe means to what? To bring out. Not this whole notion around, because this is the worst thing that you can get in a teacher ed program. That young folks are these vessels to be dumped into. That's terrible. Sometimes a five-year-old can check you on what you know if you pay attention. So this whole notion around young folks having the ability and capacity to do and to make conscious decisions on their lives, even as five-year-olds. Because a lot of folks get into this age-appropriate content. And for me, that whole notion, if young folks are old enough to experience poverty, degradation, marginalization, and vulnerability, they are old enough to be told the truth. Period. I make no bones about that. The third piece, this whole notion around the posing a counter narrative to mainstream views on children of color. And this whole notion around, we operate with this deficit mentality when we talk about young folks. So we talk about, and we use slick words with it, right? You know, they have challenges reading, right? Or they are, you know, they may need special services, right? But when we look at the overrepresentation of Black and Latino, particularly males in higher, in special education, we have to ask a different set of questions. Because a good friend of mine talks to me, you know, they got all these arbitrary categories, ABD, hyperactivity, attention deficit disorder, right? A friend of mine says ABC, QXY, all these classifications. And a friend of mine always says, well, we need to understand those young folks as ABT, ain't been taught and have not been engaged. And because we have these particular understandings, we tend to devalue them. And again, I make this piece clear. I stand in solidarity with my students. I take them very seriously. I come to class every day and say, I believe in your ability to change the planet. It is a big responsibility. I know you're going through some things. So am I. I want to be honest in this space about what it is that we are here to do. Because what happens in this classroom may not be what's happening on the block. And we need to make synergy between those two spaces. And I'm not concerned with school. I do not care about school. I am concerned with your education. I'm concerned with you being able to make a conscious decision about your life at any given moment, because at any given moment, I know we are all dealing with life or death. And we make split-second choices. And to be clear about that. So that's number three. The fourth tenet. The notion of an interdisciplinary perspective. So critical race theory, now my training is actually as a qualitative sociologist. But critical race theory actually borrows from the legal profession, it borrows from philosophy, it borrows from women's studies, it borrows from African-American studies, it borrows from Latino studies, it borrows from urban planning. It's this interdisciplinary piece to investigate this missing conversation on race, because we don't have it. And it allows us, these interdisciplinary perspectives actually allow us to have a conversation about race, about class, about gender, about sexuality that is often missing in K-12 schools. So it's this interdisciplinary perspective. And then this whole notion, the last piece, around a commitment to social justice. So it's one thing to say that racism exists. In fact, a good friend of mine calls that the no shit argument, right? Oh, racism is this. Oh, well, damn. Right? But now, knowing what you know, what do you do? So again, CRT is promulgated on this notion of action. You cannot sit here and just jack your jaws. I cannot come to Dickinson College and just talk to you blatantly about race and racism and then go back and say, man, that was a good talk. It makes no sense. The reflection and time will be the test based on what I am doing to understand and defeat white supremacy. Period. And this notion of social justice. Let's break that term down, because social justice now has become the Chevy Nova of the world, right? Everybody got one. Everybody got a social justice project. Yeah, let's call it social justice. You know, we just picked up a piece off the ground. It's social justice, right? We rake some leaves. It's social justice, right? But this whole notion of really understanding, this whole notion about being able to make tangible and concrete decisions around your life based on those conditions, the work that you do to change those conditions, and that which is just as decided by the group that is experiencing a particular set of inequalities. So let me break that down. That which we, the steps that we take in our day-to-day lives of changing our condition, hence social justice, and changing our condition collectively and individually. And again, I want to put that forward, because a lot of times you all, especially as young folks, you all are going to see a lot of this kind of social justice stuff come up, and it's really not. In fact, it gets us further away sometimes from arguing about race, racism, sexism, ageism. It takes us away from these conversations that we understand and live daily, but have no language around. We just know it. And the lawyers always called us the difference between a de facto and a de jure. But this whole notion of de facto being the tradition and practice, de jure just meaning the policy, the language. So again, these day-to-day struggles that we have with this, because again, I'm trying to be painfully honest with my students. I understand that at any given moment, my PhD will not save me, right? And sometimes folks, as my grandmother always says, sometimes people who look like myself can get a PhD and want to act brand new, right? And folk know what may not know what brand new means. So for those who are visiting with us, brand new means that you act like somebody who you are not. And just because somebody put a little money in your pocket and a funky set of letters behind your name, you feel that you're somebody else. And that is bankrupt. It is not only bankrupt, it is disrespectful to the people who have raised you. So when people talk about this whole notion around, you know, not being able to speak to their mama, homie, go back to the store with that. Don't come in my class. Don't come to me talking about it. You can't have a conversation with the people who brought you up in this place, because now you've elevated yourself. It is irrelevant to me. This whole notion that at any given moment, I'm walking down the street in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and I become the quote unquote, I fit the what? Please see me and they say, right, he fits the what? Description, right? Then I say, oh, wait, don't shoot. I got a PhD. Please. Right? And we have to be clear about that. And again, that's why I actually talk the way I talk. That's actually why I engage my students in the way that I engage my students. Because I understand at any given moment, their situation can be my own instantaneously. And I have to be clear about that. So again, all those five tenets, making them make sense, and then asking a larger question. What does this really look like? How do you do this in a K-12 classroom? High school seniors every morning, first period, right? So one of the things that we start off with is this difference between school and education. And they always look at me funny when I say that. All right, y'all, write it on the board. And I say, what's the difference? And they go, what? And then they say, all right, well, let's think about it. How many of y'all can actually say that you liked school? And then, you know, maybe one person will raise their hand up and then everybody will start laughing. Then they say, no, he don't like school. She don't like school. And then this whole notion around, how many of y'all felt like you were experiencing a painful death in school? Then they go, dang. I say, yeah, a painful death, like somebody is poking you in the head with a pencil, right? And then they go, yeah, sometimes it be like that, right? Then I say, well, at what moment do you actually feel like somebody not only cared about what you were talking about, but was actually willing to risk to tell you the truth? And then folks say, well, man, I didn't experience that till I got here. And they're seniors, right?
and have been with me for 4 years. And I say, why is that? What have we not done as teachers? Where has been our failure in actually addressing the issues and concerns that you have and the understandings about the world? Because the world says something about you as young folks. My argument as an adult, that most of it is wrong. Because the people who actually do that research are afraid to talk to you. They watch you from observation towers. They keep a distance from you to trying to be anthropologically correct or sociologically correct. They fear you. For what? And often of them, a lot of them forget that they themselves were in high school. And then when you tell them about what happens at the high school, and they go, oh my God, I can't believe it. It's so crazy. They was the main ones smoking weed, chasing people, the whole nine. Right? It always kills me with that. Like, all the people who the most prim and proper were the wildest in high school. Y'all seen that? Mm-hmm. So this whole notion around it, so we every time we see it, we actually got to call that out. And again, bringing this to the forefront. So now, we go into this notion of school versus education. The other thing is to talk about political economy. Now, political economy, you know, sometimes you say this in a high school classroom, you know, they jump down your throat, you know, you're a communist, you know, I knew, you know, actually you about to read the Communist Manifesto and Engels and everything else, right? But no, political economy, breaking down the word political, not partisan politics, but the relationships to power and how people actually exude power. The economy, the distribution and production of goods and services. So you put that together as political economy. So you're looking at the views, values, and understandings that influence a thing, whatever it is. So we get into the political economy of schools and look at how schools come into being. The school that I teach at was the result of a group of 14 parents, students, community members going on a 19-day hunger strike. They had to starve themselves to let the world know that these particular communities were actually experiencing an inequitable education. And again, they made a very conscious decision between life and death. The oldest hunger striker at the time was in her 70s. The youngest hunger striker was in high school. That was her graduating year. So this whole notion around looking at these processes and really understanding that they only get this new building, the most expensive built in the state of Illinois, to house a bunch of low-income, working-class, black and Latino youth, and then to understand it as a contested space. Because one of the communities that my school serves is being gentrified. It has the largest amount of vacant lots in the city, right? And it's accessible straight to downtown. You can take one expressway or one main street. It will take you right into downtown. So, and we look, and a lot of people are having to move. So if we look at this gentrification process, if we look at political economy, and then we start to ask this question around school, then what do these young folks begin to ask about the larger world? And again, this gets you in trouble, right? Because they're going to ask them real heady questions, because those questions are based on their experience. And their experience might be moving two or three times, having houses eminently domained, seeing different sets of neighbors over a certain set of months. And this is happening constantly. And again, these folks are coming to school, into this building. Now, what's the responsibility around education? So where do we go from that? So looking from political economy, looking from gentrification, looking at the processes that they experience, then we go into what they're interested in individually, right? And this allows us to branch into qualitative research. So we have a whole session on what qualitative research is, and we actually look at some qualitative research that's really bad. That's really bad. It talks about them. We look at the concept of the super predator. Y'all ever heard of this? This comes out late 90s around the young person who is now the profile for crimes. The super predator, aged 13 to 19, usually African-American or Latino male, commits a certain set of crimes, behaves nihilistically, right? So this whole notion of how do you actually pose a counter to this? So their narrative as posing counter to this, because we think about, we don't even understand, I mean, to really get deep into it, we don't really understand the process of gangs. We don't understand what they really are, how they really operate, many of them. Many times, especially, and some folks in social work are just kind of getting on to this, and some folks in sociology are just getting on to that, this, but when we talk about gangs, we're actually talking about surrogate families. And that is dangerous language, right? Because we think about folks talking about these kind of vile ways of behaving, but we're actually talking about a place where young folks are valued. The behavior might not be as accepted, but their understandings are valued. And they're valued in a very particular way. They are affirmed. And that might be affirmed through a handshake. That might be affirmed through a tag. That might be affirmed actually through a fight with some other set that you have beef with. So we even have to break that down and understanding what divide and conquer really is. And understanding how the process of buying into a process of white supremacy can actually teach you quicker to hate yourself. And to be honest about that. And really break down what this self-hatred is. And not to psychologize the young folks, but to ask them when they see someone else, do they see a person that could potentially save their lives, or do they see someone that they hate because they have been taught to hate them? And how these processes work. So again, being very clear about their lives as central to the process. You know, without them, my class is bogus and bankrupt. You know, their nickname for me, I've been telling folks this for the last 2 days. My students' nickname for me is low tech. Right? Because I don't got PowerPoints. I don't got the slick computer programs. I got one of them dry erase markers and a dry erase board. And we about to work it out. Right? We got some books. I got some copies. I don't use textbooks. We about to work it out. And you know, and all my, you know, I bring people to class and they got the super high tech. They got the super high tech stuff in the pointers. And they be like, Doc, how come you don't use that? I'm like, you know, I got to get right on that. That's my own self-improvement, right? I have to improve myself in dealing with them because my thing is around engagement. And in order to engage, I have to be clear about who I am as a teacher with them. And is it so much this person as an imparter of knowledge, but a facilitator of skills? Because my students know a lot. And I put their expertise in the front. By saying there's a whole lot of things that you know, but you're not giving credit around knowing them. Now, what do you say to the larger world that has made these particular assumptions about you? How do you move in a place that in some places will not want you to be there and will make all types of excuses for you not being there? So again, I feel as if I am in the process of engaging my students to fight like holy hell, because they are very much in this world. And I always pick a line from the MC Common, and he says, revolution is another name for life fighting. So again, not because death is finite, right? You know, when people say, I'll die for this, I always say, well, let's flip that around. Will you live for this? And if you will live for this, what does it look like? How do you understand it? What will you do? And again, I say this, and some of y'all may look at me crazy as tonight, and I speak with this type of intensity because I know every day I'm with them in the cut. There is not a moment where they are not on my mind. And I'm clear about that. But again, there's some struggles in that. Because the larger system does not reward this. Social justice transformative teaching is not rewarded. In fact, it's chided. In fact, you will be pushed closer to the edge of the school for engaging this type of work. You will be challenged in many ways because telling falsehoods is easy. It's simple. It gets you off the hook. It gives you an escape route. But if you go about this transformatively, at any given moment, you're prepared to say that you do not know. But let's find out. And to be intentional about that. So again, this type of relationship that we're talking about is one that is not popular. I do not want to lie to you. I talked about that this morning. I do not want to make this kind of this, oh, you know, we just have social justice and it's a beautiful thing. Mm-mm. We are talking about engaged struggle in a very serious way. And a struggle that not only is about us engaging in class, but for the young folks who come after us. So about sustainability. So a good friend of mine always tells his students, look, we have engaged in this work. One of you in this classroom better replace me in the next 25 years. If not, I will come and find you. Right? This whole notion around it, and we think this, and I don't want folks to get this twisted, because a lot of people think, well, Dave, you know, you teach social studies. The teacher that I got that from is a chemistry teacher. Every morning, his students recite a quote. I am a critical chemist. I am committed to the study of chemistry and its effect on my daily life. Every day. So they're looking at SIM cards. They're looking at coal fire plants. They've actually, he created a unit called the Science of Bling to talk about precious metals. And precious metals and stones. So this is the science teacher, y'all, not the crazy social studies teacher, right? The math teacher. They are currently doing an integrated algebra project around voter turnout, right? So they're actually looking at polls and breaking this thing down. So this whole notion around doing this and not the, these aren't your high performing students. These are students who have just demonstrated a commitment to this particular area. So this whole notion of how we actually engage this and the ways in which we gauge this, the way in which we engage this, excuse me, is possible. It's doable. But the thing is, where is our commitment? And again, these conversations are not safe. They are often painful, most painful to you because you haven't discussed them. And it will take you to the deepest depths of yourself. One of the things that we have to understand now, before we even get to classroom management and discipline and what have you, one of the most important things for teachers to understand in order to do this job well is themselves. Then the school. Then how the school is run and then the political economy of that particular school. Then your content. And we actually invert that order in colleges of education. And that is a grave mistake. And y'all folks are paying a price for that. Because we're not told to be honest. We're told to be authoritarian. You know, to see that this is, you know, it's my way or we're going to be fighting. Right? But again, being able to take that challenge in opposed to, well, you know, you got Roberto in class. Oh, my God, I just had terrible. Nah. Hey, Roberto, what's going on? You need to talk about this? Hey, look, man, I'm glad you're here. Let's get down. That fighting, talking tough is not impressing me. Change how we think and act. Change what the world says about you. Be willing to be out there on Front Street. I will not leave you hanging. Hold me to that. If I do, I have bankrupted myself. Period. And that's the conversation that I have with my young folks. And again, not fun and games, because, you know, y'all might come to observe my class and we might just be laughing, right? But again, I understand I take them seriously. And because I take them seriously, I do particular things in understanding that seriousness. So going back to critical race theory, again, in education, It's important to understand that these things are real and these conversations that we don't have. But more importantly is the work that we do based on our understandings. If there's one thing I want to impress on you all tonight, talk is the cheapest, especially in academia, because we pay to talk. Let's be clear about that. So that action is really me as an employed academic stepping out on Front Street and saying, let's put this theory to a test. Because like you said, folks have written nice things about it, professed about it, been on CNN talking about it. But go to first period in the morning and let's see how you can grind that out. And then when you come back about what's happening in the first period, then maybe we can have a conversation on how to move this forward. And again, it is work that I am honored to do. I am honored by my students every day when I see their faces. But I understand that at any given moment, one of us may not return the next day. And I take that seriously. I want my young folks, and excuse my emotion, I want my young folks to understand that we are talking about life and death. Mine and their own. And not this kind of, you know, I'm not coming in class, you know, as Conan the Barbarian just swinging a hatchet. No, y'all better be prepared for when they come to kill you. No. This whole notion around how do we engage in the business of life fighting? Fighting for stuff that should already be guaranteed. But we live in a different place. So, Barack Obama will not free people of color in the United States. It is important to understand that. One love to him if he does reach that plateau. But with the understanding of his victory, I understand that it is that much more work to do. Because now the heat will come in a very different way. It will be nuanced in ways that I can't fathom. But again, we have to be committed to do this. We have to be willing to put ourselves out there. And there is risk. And I want to be honest about that. But I believe the struggle is righteous. I'm willing to go to the mat around that. And some nights I don't come out that great. I must be honest. But others are reflective of the possibility of what is real and the possibility of what happens when you tell the truth. And what happens when you're not afraid? Because now it's like, you know, now, I mean, and people would always say, well, like, well, Stovall, you're talking like you got tenure. I said, that don't matter. I'll get a gig. That's a gig. We're talking about life situations here, homie. It's deeper than that. Right? And then they messed up and gave me tenure. Damn, right? I'm like, I mean, I was telling folks today, earlier today, my first 5 years of academia should be everything to do not to get tenure. I've been fighting with the dean in international conferences, you know, running, not going to the meeting, not filling out paperwork, people coming, running, calling about me not filling out paperwork, talking about where, you know, putting me off as a rabble rouser, this whole thing. And then the paperwork came in. I said, well, look at that. Dang. But again, in the critical race theory understanding of the world, tenure does not mean that you won't get fired. Tenure just means that it's harder to fire you. Right? So we got to be clear about that. Again, that's a very particular understanding that we must know. And again, not to fear that, but to be clear about it and moving based on that clarity. So what I do is based on that clarity. So when they come, I know they're coming. You know, I know it, right? You know, they brought me, I remember I got a letter from the feds to come to D.C. And I looked, I was like, oh, shit, damn. They done got me. You know, I called my mom, was like, man, I'm going to D.C. Look, if I don't come back, call all the homies, let them know what happened. You know, I'm going to be all right. Right? But this whole notion around even how they look at you, right? I mean, I know my dissertation goes into a file with the feds just because I mentioned the word race in the title. It automatically gets suspended. It automatically gets submitted. One of my friends works for the DEA. He said, Stove, you know you're on a list, right? And I was like, yeah. He said, okay, I just want to let you know. Right? So this whole notion around, and not me as big, tough dude, but understanding that this stuff has consequences. And you can't use it for kind of popular fodder. Right? I am only the sum total of the work that I am doing based on my understandings. Period. Anybody in this room at any given moment has every right to call me on it. So I tell my students all the time, if you see me drunk out in the street rolling like I'm crazy, you ain't got to come to class no more. Because I've bankrupted myself. And that's the commitment that I've made. So this type of work, again, and I'll end on this, it is doable. It is possible. We need more of y'all. But my job at this moment is to support y'all in doing it. And I have to be clear about that. I have to rally up my allies and be supportive of folks who are trying to do this work. I have to be intentional about my language around race. I have to be intentional about how race and class intersect with gender, sexuality, ageism, and ability oppression. And be clear. And the commitment is only demonstrated based on the work that I'm willing to do. So let me stop it right there and let's go ahead and entertain questions.
Thank you for your talk and comments, and I'm wondering, how do you translate this into the college classroom?
Uh-huh.
How do you bring this to the students? That's my first question. And two, second, is, you know, how can we, as higher education providers, begin to take responsibility for K through 12 education, which we talk badly about all the time, mm-hmm. as if we didn't actually train teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we do a better job?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we have to do is pair up with folks who we know are in the trenches, right? Letting folks see what's actually happening in a school. Give assignments that actually forces engagement. And what do I mean by that? Like, for example, in Chicago, a good friend of mine who's in the news now, Bill Ayers, has an assignment that I think is amazing. He actually asks people to ride the bus line or a train line from end to end and to record all the things they see in that process and ride a bus or train line that they've never ridden before and record those spaces and see those things. And again, begin to look at, you know, let them go out and observe schools. Let them actually engage with conversations with young folks. And it's a really interesting piece because there's older, especially with undergrads, because you got older, they're a little bit older, really a lot just removed from high school, and then folks who are still in high school. And let them see that interaction. You know, really begin to talk about them. Pair up with teachers that you know about that do what they do well. Because a lot of times we don't pair folks up to see excellence. We pair folks up with people who signed up to take a student teacher, right? So this whole notion around, no, let's get them with folks who actually do their job well. And then in a classroom space, in a college classroom space, be unapologetic around this language, you know, and let them see it. Let them see what other folks are talking about, you know. Let them hash it out and argue it. And then, you know, even call folks. You know, preempt, it's always think about, I always tell folks, and people look at me wry, and this, people say this comment is gendered, and I always say, it's like relationships. You tell folks that you're about to do something, so when you do it, the hit isn't as hard. right? So I'm always thinking about my girlfriend. And I say, okay, I'm about to do this. Okay, I'm about to do it. And then when I do it, she doesn't say what. And then I say, well, remember when I told you? And then she goes, no, it's almost like the missing. It's almost like pulling back the bottle that she's about to throw. Right. Because it's almost like, well, yeah, you're right. You did say it. Right. But to be intentional about this, like, hey, look, this conversation. You know, I go so far as to say, hey, y'all, look, I'm going to talk about this stuff in class. And if y'all aren't really too, you know, if y'all not willing to really talk about this, this might not be the class for you. Right. And to just be intentional about that. And it's funny, every time I do that, everybody stays, right? Because now you got a little, you know, edge to you. Wow, that was edgy, right? But that whole notion around really, because when you say that, but again, live up to that, right? To be like, hey, look, you know, this, I am clear about what it is that I do. You know, and this stuff is not, it's not popular, and it might ruffle some feathers, but let's get down with that. And if we're going, you know, because if we're talking about teaching young folks, we got to be prepared for that. You know, because what happens when a young person, when you are in class, and a young person that you might have seen the day before is no longer there, and then you find out they've been killed. You know, this happened to me twice. Right? In the 4 years at the high school, I've lost 2 students. Right? And this whole notion around what does that actually mean, right? In terms of, where does it go? But I mean, I think those things, you know, really being, I think the more intentional we are, the better off our students are, because it allows them to experience a particular perspective. And I even say that, I say mine is a particular perspective on schools and education and the process. There are many others, but this is just one, and I'm willing to engage that space. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. When you're describing, when you're describing your classroom and your school, and all the students are African American and Latino students, you're opening up that discussion in somewhat of a safe environment, because mm-hmm. everybody there shares a fairly common experience of mm-hmm. being. Mm-hmm. What now is a minority, but soon won't be in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very different demographic on our campus, and also the public schools around here where we place our education students, a very different demographic where there is a very clear white majority,
mm-hmm.
and where within a class you may have one African-American student or one Latino student, and to open up those conversations can be much less comfortable than where you are. So what's your suggestion when you're in a whole different demographic mm-hmm. as we are?
2 things, identity and family history. There's an excellent body of work by Christine Sleater, her as a white woman actually investigating her family history and actually what has actually transpired and what were the historical moments in locating their family history. And then a lot of times this notion around questions around culture. How do we understand culture? Because a lot of times, especially in affluent schools, you'll get students that answer, I don't have a culture. You know, you may have heard that. Well, I don't have a culture. I'm like, everybody has a way of doing or knowing. Now, what has been your experience in that? Where are your folks from? And even when the conversation stops and folks won't, family members won't talk about this particular situation, you can even inquire as to why they won't talk about it. And then you get into a discussion around pain. So this whole notion around how do we actually understand this pain and how is this pain contributed to ourselves? And then where are our families located in these historical moments? Because a lot of times in those particular stories, you'll find a family member who will be more than happy to break out this, break out the family history and really get to explain, because, and another thing that it does, it values the elders who are often kind of shunned away in families. And then this notion around identity, you know, who are they in the world? Who do they see themselves as? How do they see, how is their school experience shaped their understanding? Have they rejected school altogether? See, that's always a tough thing for a teacher to ask, right? Because they take it personal around their own rejection. But really saying, you know, well, how many of y'all have said, you know, this school thing ain't working? Why? And really begin to value their space, but to contextualize their space in these other historical moments. So again, getting them to begin to talk about these spaces. And again, there's going to be a whole lot of resistance. And let folks know that. It's going to be a ton of resistance. But again, keep trudging at it. Because what it actually allows to do, because that one black student, that one Latino student, they now are getting the understanding that they themselves are actually valued in that space. Even in that hostile environment, because that environment should be understood as hostile. But again, they're valuing, you know, in that classroom as sanctuary in this particular moment. But have folks talk about this, because again, I mean, it just introduced times that it won't. I mean, this whole notion around, a good friend of mine has a teacher at a school, and she has them read How the Irish Became White, which is a really interesting piece that folks just kind of look at. Whoa, hey, wow. You know, and it's a whole series of it, right? It's how the Italians became white, how the Jews became white. You know, this whole notion around it, because it talks about persecution, and the stories are reflective of these particular historical moments. And it's a good tool to actually bring folk in to the conversation, because it draws from these various historical moments. So I think those pieces entering those conversations.
Then you've got African American folks who are not going to become white folks, mm-hmm. and Latinos who are not going to become white folks. So how does that work?
Break it out. Break it right out. And say, well, some, there are other experiences here. No, to always be reflective of the countless number of experiences that are in the class. So if they're reading that, we'll see this whole notion of trajectory and how folks, and have them read some Howard Zinn, right? And let them see a documentary called You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. Right? Because here's this older white dude who says, hey, look at this. Here's how it goes. This is really what history has become. Have them read James Lawrence Lies My Teacher Told Me. Have them read the Helen Keller's chapter. Because that thing, we have totally anesthetized Helen Keller to the Melissa Gilbert movie. And, you know, folks tumbling around me. Nobody knows that she was a radical socialist, right? You know, that had all these particular understandings. So change up the paradigm in how we tell these stories to include them, and then allow folks to tell their own story in the same paradigm. Mm-hmm. Questions?
What types of policy are needed to complement the transformative movement going on in the classroom?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. I think one of the biggest things around actually putting forward something transformative is really changing the funding equations for schools. Change the equation on how schools are funded. I think that's a huge thing. And I think that's something that's actually possible and doable. And it comes from, but it has to be a commitment. It has to be this political will around both state and federal agencies committing to that process. And the second thing, oversight that sees that the money's afforded to particular schools, states, and districts gets to the students and doesn't widen the bureaucracy. Because a lot of times when school districts get cash, they just hire another random administrator in opposed to actually getting it down to the young folks who need it most. Let schools assess themselves and actually come out around what their needs are. And then, based on that needs assessment, apply those funds and then have oversight to see that those funds have actually gotten to those spaces. So I think that's one thing that comes out. Another piece, change this kind of random, benign set of high-stakes testing and standards. Because this is what we know about tests. And, you know, American Testing Service, College Board, everybody says it. The test is indicative of how well you did on a particular day, at a particular moment, and it only assesses how well you took the test. It is not any sign of aptitude or ability to complete college. It just barely gives a predictive measure around how you're going to do in the first year. And the rest of them say that they can't even do that. Well, the SAT is the only one that claims that. The ACT, they don't even claim it anymore, right? But this whole notion around change up that paradigm. And one of the ways, and a lot of institutions of higher ed are doing this, is actually going to a portfolio development, portfolio analysis of applications. So instead of having this kind of blanket test score, a couple of pieces, have a portfolio that actually shows what you actually did throughout those 4 years and before various pieces and allows a longer writing sample or what have you. But again, schools have actually gone that way and committed to those things. But I think those are some things that readily we can do. And then not, in terms of teacher ed, not being afraid. I mean, really have in your classes, so when we talk about urban context, when we talk about social context, break down these standards, right? Look at them. You know, look at them in class and say, okay, in this subject they ask you to do this. Now, you can choose how you want to adjudicate those standards, but these standards kind of lie. And look at some examples of how people have inverted these very scripted curriculums, right? And how that can change perspective by the teacher ed candidate who's about to go into the classroom. So I think those things come readily to mind when I think about how something that we can do immediately in terms of, and the school funding piece is a longer push, but I think that stuff around portfolio analysis, even for high school graduation, and this notion around looking differently at doing more infusion early on in teacher ed is doable, very doable in particular cases. Please.
I was going to ask actually about the No Child Left Behind Act. And I actually worked in a school in fifth grade. And in the state of Pennsylvania, that's one of the big testing years. And that was the major focus of that year, was that test. And I know especially the school that I worked in, we're not necessarily, well, I don't work there anymore, but that school is not necessarily a higher scoring school. Mm-hmm. So anything that is not tested, like you're talking about Howard Zinn. I mean, these are fifth graders, so I don't think they'd be able to comprehend Howard Zinn. Okay.
They get it.
But how, like, do you get confrontations about that? Because, I mean, that's a big funding piece, and schools are really focused on that. So how do you deal with that sort of aspect of No Child Left Behind, you know, gearing up for a big test and have to do with funding for the school, mm-hmm. but then also, you know, creating citizens of the future, mm-hmm. not just like bubble colorers.
Right, exactly. Well, this whole notion around really, like, the woman who actually trained me as a fifth grade teacher, she used to have this drill with her students that I thought was excellent. And she was playing a joke with me one day, and she said, watch this. She said, Stovall, watch this. She said, class, how do we take tests? And they all say, well, we got what the test says, what we learned in the class, and the truth. And then she says, does one and two always match? And they go, no. Wow. But in having that particular space, you don't get into this notion, because a lot of times we get handcuffed by that. Because a lot of times, you know, even with our school, you know, if we would have went on probation, we would have had all these measures around how to make sure that that performance is up. But the thing is that I always tell teachers, make sure you are communicating what it is that you're trying to communicate. The standards are benign. Those will take care of themselves when we look at achievement differently. Achievement as how they have improved over time in opposed to the moment on the test. And very little, and that actually kind of takes away this test prep piece, because the test prep starts to anesthetize folks. You know, they start to just reject. It's like, come on, man. Then, you know, how do even school systems think, right? They give them the crackers and the juice. You know, they're just like, come on, man. This is crazy. You know, and the young folks are like, man, the crackers are stale. The juice is bad. It's like, do they? It's like one of my students was like, man, doc, I thought they was trying to kill me, man. I'm choking off the crackers. Juice is terrible. I'm spitting up all over the tent. I mean, you know, this whole notion around how this stuff to even break out from that. And really look at those standards after you've done your lesson plan. Because the standards are benign. You can map those pieces right on the stuff that you do with your student. You can map them right onto the standards, right? But the piece now becomes the question around content, right? So how do you, when they say they need to write an expository letter, you know? I was talking about this example earlier today. You know, what if they write a letter to Columbus, right? You went the wrong way, you know? How you go the wrong way, call people different names, and if you was alive, I'd kick you in the knee, you know? But this whole notion around how we even do these types of things, because one inversion that I've seen that was excellent, a guy actually used a very scripted curriculum called, I don't know if folks are familiar, I don't know if they had this in Pennsylvania, Open Court, which is a high school, which is a grade school reading curriculum. And he used Open Court, and it was this whole thing about a dog. And it was a thing about expository letter writing. He had it so that his students wrote a letter and presented at a union rally about their school. But this whole notion around really taking, and the other thing, and I'm sorry that I didn't say this during the actual talk. This type of thing is extra work. And I have to be honest about this. When we talk about the difficulties, it's extra work. So you're going to have to look at what's happening. You got to say, that's not a whole. So a lot of brain power is used in this and understanding that it's extra work and that extra work. But the extra work is actually so you don't have to feel like you're handcuffed by these standards. I mean, that's the biggest thing, because you know, we get, especially with first through third year teachers, right? They come in and, you know, you just get slammed with this paperwork, and then you told us you got to meet X, Y, Z, and then you just stand there like, God, what is this? You know, I didn't come here for this, right? But this whole notion around how do we even, so going back to your question in terms of preparing folks, you know, how do you prepare folks for dealing with those situations? Because they should be understood as duress. You know, that's working under duress. And that whole notion around even having these strategies to alleviating duress. So this whole notion around really being intentional about that. So yeah, do your pieces first, then the standards, and then all the, because that piece, and your students will actually, and a lot of that is in relationship building too, because then your students are able to see that, hey, look, oh wow, she's really interested in us and not this other stuff. And I cannot profess more how much they take to that, how much young folks appreciate that, because in so many instances, we have devalued them. You know, we do not take them seriously. And because we don't, we got to sit down, shut up, line up, all this type of pieces. But again, that content is actually developing them and saying, okay, this is some different stuff to learn about. This is different ways to go about it.
Mm-hmm. On behalf of Dickinson College and the Clark Forum, I would like to thank our speaker, Professor Stovall. At this time, I would like to remind you of the informal discussion taking place in the House Cyber Room 206 tomorrow at 12:30 p.m. This concludes tonight's program. Thank you for coming and have a good evening.